Hi, this is a takeaway for Tuesday, November 21st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and in the 2 minutes it takes me to welcome you to the show today, a gun will be stolen somewhere in America. And that moment, the theft of a gun, has already come for many of you.
Hi, my name's Leanne. I'm calling from Olympia, Washington. My mom had about 20 guns stolen. An old friend of hers offered to take them and appraise them after my dad died. After he left the house, she never saw or heard from him again. She was so embarrassed about being scammed that she never reported it.
It's Forrest Barber. I'm calling from Fort Worth, Texas. I did have a firearm stolen from my vehicle about 2 years ago. I did report it to the police, and last year I was notified that the firearm was located now at a pawn shop here in Fort Worth.
Ramble Westfall. I'm calling from Orville. I did have a .22 pistol stolen one time. Was pretty sure I knew who had done it, and when I called the sheriff's department to report it stolen, they were familiar with the individual and told me not to expect it to ever be recovered.
It is Jay from Anchorage, Alaska. My friend's pistol was stolen from his truck. He reported it to the police. It has not been recovered yet.
My name is Jeff from Orlando, Florida. Somebody had stole my own gun a long time ago.
This is Chris from South Carolina. When the report was made of a stolen firearm, I was told it was more likely I'd never get it back and that the report was there mainly to protect me in case any crime was committed with it.
But it's only a matter of time. They'll find it.
I learned a lesson. Lock your guns up at all times.
Those guns are gone and they're out there somewhere in the world.
The stories are all different, but the numbers are staggering. At least 2 million guns stolen over the last 10 years, 237,000 stolen in 2016 alone. And those are just the thefts reported. Many more go unaccounted for altogether. These overwhelming numbers come from a year-long investigation by The Trace and NBC, looking at records from more than 1,000 state and local police departments. And they show that America is missing a key factor in our ongoing debate over buying guns and keeping guns. It's that in a country awash in nearly 300 million firearms, millions are taken from their lawful owners and used to promote violent crime. Brian Frescos is an investigative reporter for The Trace, and he led the investigation. Brian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Brian, the number of guns stolen in America is staggering, according to what you found. 2 million in a decade, and that number could be as high as 3.5 million because it's probably underreported. What are the biggest findings from your investigation?
Well, what we found in regards to the statistics is that number has been on a sharp rise. And we think that that is because, one, there are just a lot more guns out there. Recent studies by Harvard and Northeastern universities estimate that there are about 270 million guns in circulation in the United States. That's about 70 million more than there were in the mid-1990s. So there are just more guns to steal, frankly. But then we also know that laws have an effect. Research has shown that people who carry their guns outside of the home, people who store them in their cars, are significantly more likely to experience gun theft. And we found that in a lot of states, lawmakers have made it easier to do both things. They have expanded the number of places where someone can carry a weapon. Sometimes they've, in about a dozen states, they've eliminated all licensing requirements altogether to carry a weapon. And what we saw when we looked at the city level statistics is that immediately after they changed these laws, there tended to be a sharp increase in the number of gun thefts in those places.
So there are two phenomena here, Brian. One is the sharp rise in gun thefts, which you've laid out. And then you have to make the connection to how those guns are getting onto crime scenes, how they're being used in violent crimes. How do you make that connection?
Well, what we did is we filed a ton of public records requests and ended up collecting data from about 1,000 police departments, a little bit more than 1,000 police departments. And what that data was, it was data on guns that had been reported stolen to the police department and then guns that had been recovered by the police department. And so we took all that data and put it into a big database and were able to make connections between the two. So we looked at the serial number and other identifying markings on the guns that had been reported stolen, and then we matched that to recovered guns, guns that had been recovered by the police department in connection to another crime. And what we found is that out of the 1,000 police departments that we looked at, they recovered about 23,000 guns, stolen guns, between 2010 and 2016. And those were recovered in connections to crimes ranging from a felon who got pulled over and had a gun in his glove box to robberies and assaults and even murders.
But how are these guns then making their way from the houses or the trucks or the businesses where they're stolen into the hands of criminals? Is it all just black market sales out of the backs of cars?
Yeah, well, that seems to be a sort of a blind spot, something that researchers don't know much about. There was a study out of Chicago that showed that most of the criminals who are using the guns are not the same ones who are stealing the guns. So we do think that once the guns are stolen, they're trading hands. They're being, you know, traded for drugs. They're being sold for money. But they're somehow switching hands in the black market before they're turning up at a crime scene.
But Brian, given the huge number of guns that you say are stolen, even 23,000 recovered by police between 2010 and 2016, I mean, the numbers here are staggering, and it's surprising that this isn't something more widely talked about. Is it something that police departments say is on their radar and that they've been worried about?
Yeah, it's something that's been on law enforcement's radar for a long time. The International Association of Chiefs of Police made it a priority this year to develop a program that police departments and sheriff's offices could use to sort of raise awareness and encourage people to store their guns safely. And so what they've done is they've come up with this public service announcement that they hope to air online and to generate some media attention that shows someone stealing a gun out of an unlocked car and then going on a robbery spree. What I've kind of noticed, and what we kind of noticed at the Trace, is that a lot of the national discussion seems to be focused on the theft of guns from gun stores and other licensed gun dealers. And that certainly is a problem, and it's been on a sharp rise. There's about 9,300 guns stolen from licensed dealers in 2016, which is a sharp rise over the year before. But that only accounts for a small fraction of the guns that are stolen every year from just everyday owners out of their cars and homes and things like that.
But Brian, 275 million guns in America, as many as 3.5 million stolen over a decade. Public service announcements are not going to do it here. Do we need much stiffer penalties for people who don't secure their guns?
Well, that's something that the public and lawmakers are going to have to debate. But what law enforcement officials and gun violence prevention advocates have been pushing for are more of what we call safe storage laws. These are laws that require gun owners to keep their guns locked in a safe or locked with a locking device of some kind. Right now, only about 4 states have those laws, and only one of those states, Massachusetts, requires guns to be kept under lock and key pretty much any time the gun owner isn't using them. The other states are California, New York, and Connecticut, and they only require that guns be locked under certain situations, like if the owner lives with a convicted felon or a domestic abuser. So that's one possible prescription. Another one that people have been pushing for is a requirement that gun owners report losses and thefts. So there was some research that came out recently that suggested that only about a quarter of gun thefts are never reported. And this is a problem for law enforcement because it helps them, when people report their weapons stolen, it just helps them track them down and get them off the street and helps them file charges against the people who are caught with them.
But Brian, before we let you go, look, there's a reality here that I think you can't get around. If only 4 states in this country have locking laws, safe storage laws, and a quarter of all gun thefts are never reported, thieves know that. They know that stealing a gun is a safe bet.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a huge problem. And I think what the irony here is that most people are buying guns to protect themselves. But what's happening when a gun is stolen is they're inadvertently arming the people that they're trying to protect themselves against. So then when that gun gets used in another crime, it sows the same fears that prompted people to arm themselves in the first place.
Brian Frescos, investigative reporter for The Trace. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're listening there to cell phone footage obtained by CNN of humans being sold into slavery in Libya. After getting that video, CNN sent a team to Libya to investigate the slave trade, and last week aired a report that showed young men from Niger being sold off as slaves to work on farms in Libya. CNN senior international correspondent Nima El-Baghir was part of the team in Libya, where she witnessed an auction firsthand, holding one of 2 secret cameras while watching men sell other men. Nima, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for asking us on.
Nima, the footage that you and your team got for this piece and produced is shocking, and I confess, it's sickening. What did you see in Libya?
We arrived knowing that there were a number of auctions, which in and of itself is unbelievable, a number of auctions happening within the time frame that we were planning on being in country in. And so, I guess the only word to use is devastatingly, we actually had a choice as to which one we would go to. So we narrowed it down in terms of security and in terms of just the feasibility of extraction. And we went into one, and only 20 minutes away, another one was happening. So it was this darkened house. A lot of the people who'd come along to the auction had actually parked around the back. So as we approached from the front, it seemed like this utterly nondescript, normal looking house. And we walked in, and you could tell that they were little perturbed, but not perturbed enough to stop. They were still incredibly brazen, and they kept going. And the only thing I can liken it to is when you watch horse auctions, you know, when people are kind of G-ing up the bidders and they're going, oh, you know, what am I bid? Oh, was that an 800? Yep, I got an 800 over there. And it was just, I remember in the moment feeling like this is happening so quickly. I need to figure out what our next move is. And that's when you see us in the video, we're kind of hustled out because it was finishing, and us kind of trying to talk our way back in. And it was amazing to watch it back, actually, because it felt like it went on for ages. It was like a good 8 minutes of footage when we went back through our cameras. But actually, in the moment, it felt like a blink of an eye.
Nima, how is this happening in Libya or anywhere else? How does a migrant, let's say from Niger in this case, wind up in a situation where they're being sold for labor?
I think this is a story of exploitation at every single possible level. So you have these people in horrifying circumstances, whether it is conflict, whether it is the situation in Eritrea, where they are forced into conscription indefinitely in the army, or even if it's just devastating economically, and they sell everything, and they're sold this dream. In Nigeria, they call them the pushermen. These are the brokers for the smugglers, and they're essentially told, you know, we'll get you to Europe. So that, I feel like the exploitation starts there. And then you go through these different stages where you are passed from one smuggling network to another. So there are the smuggling networks inside the borders of the country of origin. And then there are the kind of the transition people. And then there are the people that you're handed to at the end in Libya at the point of departure for Europe. And it's there where now we're seeing this bottleneck, where the migrants are building up in the warehouses because the Libyan Coast Guard has been supported increasingly by the Italians financially and in other ways to block the movement of boats to Europe. And so when we were listening to the way they were talking about them, this is how they were describing them. We have an excess of merchandise. And that's how they talked about these human beings. We have an excess of merchandise. And so we need to make money off this merchandise. These people are sitting in our warehouses and they're eating and this is an expenditure. And so it became an alternative way of making money. So what we didn't manage to get into the piece, and we got into some of the written work that we did, was that the first step is that they call those within the circle of trust that are close to them, and they say, I have 50, let's say, extra boxes this week sitting in my warehouses. Does anybody need anything? And then you'll put out the word and say, oh, I need a gardener, or I need a cleaner. And then once there is still excess beyond that, that's when they have the auctions. So what you saw in those auctions were what the smugglers were referring to as excess merchandise.
Excess merchandise sitting in our warehouses. Nima, what governments know about this now, whether it's Libya or the Italians, and how can it go on one more day if people now know about it?
I mean, that is the question. And what's really heartened us about the response to this internationally is that knowing has now been admitted to publicly. This isn't the first such report. I accept that seeing it visually has a huge impact. I get that. We showed the smoking gun. But the International Organization of Migration was raising these reports to the UN. The International Criminal Court, the office of the prosecutor there, Fatou Bensouda, was in the UN speaking to the Security Council in May of this year, asking to have her portfolio, where she's looking into the Gaddafi-era crimes in Libya, having that enlarged to take in the crimes that are being committed against the migrants. It is naive to say we didn't know. We did know. The world did know. It's just you have what is essentially a country that is teetering into failed statehood. So how do you begin to unpick that? How do you begin to support them in a meaningful way? In this interconnected world, it's extraordinary that we have allowed Libya to become what it is. And these are the ramifications of that.
Libya is what it is, and maybe they don't have the ability to enforce their own laws in this case, Nima. But these human merchants continue to operate. Is the UN, is Italy, is the United States going to put a stop to it?
Well, we haven't heard from the US yet, which is why it's great to speak to you. But the UN Secretary General yesterday gave a statement saying that he would be making available UN resources. And what needs to happen is we need to have, or they in the Security Council need to have a session actually genuinely debating the freeing up of resources. What do the Libyans need? In practical terms, the Libyans need actual resources. I mean, you saw the images in the detention center. I mean, putting aside the criminality and the horror of the sale of human beings, even when they're rescued and they're put in those detention centers, the day that we visited that detention center, there was a citywide water shortage in Tripoli. So for days, those migrants had been drinking out of toilet cubicles. I mean, the inhumanity goes across the board. And again, the world, in terms of the UN and world leaders and governments, knew this was happening. The hope is that now that there has been such outrage on a popular level, on a public level, that people can actually be held to account, and the UN can be asked, and the White House can be asked, and number 10 can be asked, what are you practically doing?
Human beings are being sold into slavery in Libya, and Nima El-Baghir and her colleagues have the proof. Nima, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nima El-Baghir is a senior international correspondent with CNN. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. An international search is underway for an Argentinian submarine lost off the coast 6 days ago with 44 crew members on board. According to the Argentine Navy, the San Juan reported a battery failure last Wednesday and was ordered to return to port. Since then, there's been no contact with the crew, and search operations have been hampered by severe weather. Paul Byrne is senior producer for the Associated Press, and he joins me now from the Argentine Naval Base in Mar del Plata. Paul, welcome to The Takeaway.
Pleasure to talk to you guys.
Paul, what do investigators actually know about the ARA San Juan and where it may have gone?
Well, the thing is, Todd, it seems like all the time they seem to know less. For instance, yesterday at one point, it seems there had been, in the most recent press conference, they announced that there was some detection made of sound coming from a vessel. But later that night, they confirmed that it wasn't actually any connection with the missing San Juan that has been out of communication for 6 days now, and it was some environmental sound. So as the hours pass by, Todd, the level of desperation is growing here. We're speaking to family members outside, and they remain very stoic, but you know, as the hours pass by, as the days pass by, as the communications change about certainties about communication with the ship, and then it turns out that they can't manage to confirm these communications, people are beginning to get, you know, increasingly desperate about the situation.
Paul, the Navy announced on Monday, the Argentine Navy, that the San Juan reported a battery failure on Wednesday before contact was lost. What do experts say about what that could mean for where the ship is?
Well, basically, the official line is that there is no direct connection between that. It's quite a common failure. It happened in the build-up to last Wednesday. So the official line is that there is no direct connection between the two. But, of course, there is a lot of speculation that any type of faults in the days leading up to the last communication obviously would lead you to believe that that could have been some connection to the fact that the San Juan has been missing now for 6 days. But there's no direct correlation at the moment confirmed.
Paul, the oxygen supply aboard that ship has to be limited. If the San Juan has gone down, how long could a crew of 44 survive?
Well, I got to speak to a specialist yesterday who was at one time one of the board members on the San Juan, and he told me that it can last up to 90 days below water. But that totally depends on the situation. And if there is any electrical fault, if there is any form of technical difficulty, that can change dramatically. He couldn't give me an estimation because really they have no idea of what the issues are.
And I imagine in Argentina, since nobody knows where the San Juan is, there must be a lot of speculation ranging from it's at the bottom of the sea to maybe it's been stolen or somebody's absconded with it.
Yeah, as the days pass by, without any certainty, you know, there's increasing speculation about what it could be. And the simple fact is that no one knows. Again, yesterday, I had the chance to speak to one of the medical team, chief psychiatrist here in Argentina that's working with the families. And that was one of the issues he told me, is that when speculation abounds about, you know, potential reasons behind this, sometimes that gives hope. But when that hope is broken, it leads to total despair. So they're trying to manage the information that's been given out as much as possible. And basically, the Argentine Navy are controlling all that. And they keep reminding the media that are covering this that the only information that we should take into account is what the information that's released by them. But the issue is, again, is that when nothing concrete can be given, of course, that leads to growing speculation.
Argentinian submarine the San Juan has not been heard from for 6 days. The International Search and Rescue Mission is on. Paul Byrne with the Associated Press, thanks for the update.
Thank you very much, guys. Nice to talk to you.
It's Friday in northern Afghanistan. Prayers are over, and in a field on the outskirts of town, a thick cloud of dust churns and rises from the earth. At the center, dozens, maybe 100 horses massed together in what looks like a stampede. The horses ram and rear up. The men on their backs swing to the ground, risking a kick to the face. Everyone from local farmers to regional warlords are there to watch. This is Buzkashi.
I think the best way to describe Buzkashi is kind of a war on a different plane. It's the national sport of Afghanistan. The word Buzkashi means goat grabbing, but that really doesn't do it justice. For one, they usually don't play with goats anymore, so they'll play with calves. And the calves are beheaded, the hooves are taken off, they're disemboweled and then stitched up. So this is basically the game ball. And these can weigh upwards of 100 pounds in a big match.
Now, only the most masterful, maybe reckless riders ever get close to that carcass.
You'll have a field full of horsemen, and the objective is to get the calf off the ground. So these guys are reaching down in the scrum of possibly hundreds of horsemen. You have to round the flag at the far end of the field and then charge back through the scrum and drop it in the scoring circle. And that's how you win a round. And if you win a round, there are prizes, sometimes hundreds, thousands of dollars, sometimes an SUV if there's a big warlord sponsoring the match.
That's Jason Motlog. He's a former correspondent who recently traveled back to Afghanistan to cover Buzkashi for Outside Magazine. Jason says that when all the dust clears, Buzkashi opens up a window into the politics and the culture of Afghanistan.
The Buzkashi match is a free-for-all. If you arrive a little late and the match is underway, you're going to see a giant dust cloud. You'll see these horsemen sort of collapsing into each other, being kicked back, horses up on their back heels. It's really rough and tumble. you know, some of the riders might be hitting each other, each other's horses, to create chaos. So really anything goes kind of atmosphere. You know, you're going to have crowds, usually pretty poor people who come after prayers on a Friday afternoon to watch, but also the VIPs. A lot of these might be politicians. They might be local warlords. They bring their gunmen. So there are a lot of weapons around too. So it's a very charged, high stakes atmosphere.
So Jason, Buzkashi is an old game, but you've written that it's had kind of a renaissance since the latest round of warfare in Afghanistan since 2001. Why is that the case?
It has, yeah. I mean, it's sort of disputed the origin. Some think it goes back to the time of Genghis Khan and the Mongol hordes, and that they used Buzkashi as a training exercise to grab things from the ground without breaking stride for, you know, as practice for raiding and pillaging. You know, the sport has endured in Afghanistan and throughout Central Asia for centuries. After the Taliban was ousted in 2001, Buzkashi bounced back. A lot of the horses that were used in Buzkashi were killed deliberately during the war or used to run weapons. And so the horse stocks were decimated. The sport barely held on. After 2001, you had all this money coming in, all these reconstruction dollars. And that allowed some of the major warlords who were leading Buzkashi patrons to really reinvest in the sport and kind of raise the stakes. So Buzkashi has bounced back in a big way since then.
So warlords, especially in northern Afghanistan, played a critical role during many, many years of the United States war there. You're saying they play a critical role in the resurgence of Buzkashi as well. What do they do?
Very much so. The warlords have been really instrumental in rebuilding the sport. You know, Afghan horse stocks were decimated after all these years of war. So, you know, they've got the money, the means to bring some of the best horses from other Central Asian countries and pay these riders, support them really as full-time chaplains, competitors during the season. They give them room, board, whatever they need to make sure that they're successful. You know, kind of like an NFL owner would. And these teams, these riders, are sources of a lot of prestige for these warlords and players in the community. It's their sort of way of giving back and, you know, providing an entertainment, some diversion from the hardships of day-to-day life, from the war, that people can enjoy. So really as a stage for them.
Well, I mean, you always hear that sort of cliche about sports, right? That it's warfare without the blood, you know, that's what football and boxing and wrestling are for.
Yeah, except here you actually have some of the blood too, right? I mean, odds are if you sit through a Buzkashi match, someone is going to get a horse kicked to the eye or thrown from their horse. So injuries, broken bones, those things are really common.
So Jason, off the Buzkashi field, and I don't even know if it's called a field, I'll call it the field. You've talked about how this game is sort of a metaphor for Afghan society, particularly since the war. Is that a stretch? Do people in Afghanistan agree with that?
I don't think the average Afghan is really looking at Buzkashi that way. I think it's probably a lens that, you know, Western journalists are more inclined to apply to Buzkashi. You know, if you think of Buzkashi, it's this sort of chaotic battle for control of this calf. You look at Afghanistan, it's this constant flux of actors, of warlords trying to control the center. And sometimes there are alliances that are made to do that. Sometimes there are real deceptions that are needed to steal power. And so, you know, those are a lot of the same dynamics that you see in a Buzkashi match.
I wonder, with all of the Americans who've come and gone from Afghanistan in the last 15 years, look, some of those paratroopers, some of those Rangers, there was a cowboy or two in that group. Has an American ever played?
Well, I actually got to play some Buzkashi on my last trip there. And, you know, this was for Outside Magazine, so I felt like it had to be told in the first person. I had to take a crack at it. So we're out in Shibrogan, out in the northwest in these desert plains, and I had a local head of the Buzkashi Federation, a maid, arrange a kind of impromptu Buzkashi match. And I thought it was going to be a small kind of training affair. And the next morning, a couple of cars full of spectators pulled up, and he tells me that, you know, other people were going to be coming from all over. And I had to reiterate, like, no, this is just a practice session with a gringo. But anyway, we went out to the field, and I spent about 2 hours playing with these guys. And, you know, they took it easy on me. Not an easy sport by any stretch. Just picking up the calf off the ground, trying to keep the horse stable is tough when, you know, you've got a couple guys around you, never mind a scrum of 50 or 60 talented riders. So I got to try my hand at it. I also heard that some years ago, there were some Green Berets shortly after the invasion, actually, that also got to participate in the Bushkashi match. So it has been done. As it happens, a lot of the Afghans are wondering why the U.S. isn't supporting them more and raising the profile of Bushkashi. So maybe, you know, this will help in some small way toward that end.
Jason Motlog on the resurgence of the old Afghan sport of Bushkashi. Jason is founder of Blackbeard Films and a contributor to Outside Magazine. Jason, so thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Here's a story of the big money and high stakes of media mergers. The Trump administration filed a lawsuit on Monday to block AT&T's $85 billion bid to buy Time Warner. The Justice Department's top antitrust regulator said that deal would, quote, harm American consumers by combining one of the country's biggest internet and subscription television providers with a telecom giant. Now, AT&T's general counsel said the company plans to challenge the Justice Department in court. Meanwhile, some people are wondering whether President Trump's very public disdain for CNN, which is a Time Warner company, has anything to do with his administration moving to block the deal. Lena Khan is director of legal policy at the Open Markets Institute and a visiting fellow with Yale Law School. I spoke with her today to get a better sense of why the Justice Department is objecting to this expensive merger.
The Justice Department in its brief said that the main harms here are that consumers will face higher prices and less choice, and that ultimately this move will squash innovation and kind of stunt the development of the industry. So I think consumers should expect to see higher prices. They should expect to see their bill go up. And that can happen for a couple of reasons. One is that AT&T, because it will own Time Warner, can start charging rival distributors way more for the same content. So it can, you know, discriminate against rival distributors by hiking the price for Time Warner. Now, the important thing to know about Time Warner is that many of the channels that it owns are considered must-have channels. So this includes many of the Turner networks, but it also includes HBO. And both AT&T DirecTV and its internal filings have noted that acquiring this kind of must-have TV would basically mean that they'd be able to hold their rivals hostage and basically just put a gun to their head and say, you know, in order to have these must-carry channels, you have to pay us triple, quadruple, whatever amount for the same content.
Is this proposed deal between AT&T and Time Warner fundamentally different from the merger in between NBC and Comcast? That deal was allowed to go through by the Obama administration, and given that it was, is there a justification to block this one?
I think there is a justification for it to block one. You know, there are some differences on margins. That was a slightly smaller deal. But at the end of the day, these are exactly analogous deals in many key ways. I think in part, the difference we see here is a difference in philosophy. So the Obama administration believed that even if you have a merger that is anti-competitive, that is problematic, it's okay to allow it to go through if you attach what are known as conduct remedies or behavioral remedies. So you're basically saying to the new merged company, listen, we recognize you're going to be amassing a lot of power, but just promise us you're not going to abuse that power and we'll let this go through. Whereas what the Trump administration is doing is they're showing a belief in structural remedies, where they're going to look at this new company and say, we see the power that you'll be acquiring, and we think you'll have the incentive and ability to use that power in abusive ways, and we're not going to permit that. So we're going to require you to spin off certain businesses so that you no longer are structurally positioned to have the incentive and the ability to abuse this power.
Well, Lena, the mechanics and the legalities of antitrust are certainly going to be a big part of this, but politics hovers over this entire deal. There's suspicion here that the extra scrutiny that the Trump administration is lording on this deal, in fact, the effort to block the sale, has its origins in President Trump's vendetta against CNN, which is, of course, a Time Warner company. A lot of that is political speculation, but does it have a bearing on the actual case if it gets before a judge?
I have no doubt that that's something that AT&T will be playing up to the court. I'm sure, you know, already we've seen AT&T attempt to portray the DOJ's action as ludicrous and unprecedented, and suggests pretty overtly that this is being driven by the personal vendetta of the president rather than by following the rule of law. So I have no doubt that that's something that AT&T will invoke in its legal case. And I think, you know, the good thing here is that this is not just a unilateral action by the Justice Department. This is an action by the Justice Department to file a case that will be reviewed by an independent judiciary. So I think if we believe that the judiciary can act as a check and, you know, ensure that there's no improper influence driving this decision, that, you know, we have a safeguard built in here in that way.
Lena Khan with the Open Markets Institute. Lena, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And you know, you might think that the father of virtual reality would be big on escaping the real world. Turns out, not so much.
It's not about escapism at all.
That's straight from the lips of the man who coined the term virtual reality, Jerron Lanier. He's spent a career developing it and tracing its potential. Jerron Lanier has a new memoir out today. It's called Dawn of the New Everything: Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. And in the book, he explains why the rise of virtual reality can't be allowed to mean losing our humanity.
These days, there are a lot of messages coming out of the tech world that kind of make people seem unimportant, because there's this idea that the machines will come and do your jobs, they'll drive the trucks and diagnose your illnesses. You also talk to the machines as if they're people. And at the end of all of it, you wonder, am I anything special? Is there anything real in me? Or am I just another piece of mechanism, a fleshy mechanism? And I really hate that. I think it makes me sad, and I think it's just a lie. With virtual reality, there's this amazing thing that there's something floating inside it to experience it. I mean, in virtual reality, everything can change. You can change your body into some alien creature. You can change the world you're in. You can change the rules of how reality works. But there's something that remains. And what is that thing? So in a way, the best gift of virtual reality is that it proves you're real. It highlights that there's really something there. That's you. If you want to call it your soul, that's exposing your soul, because everything else changes. So what's left? Well, now we see it.
Jerron, they call you the father of virtual reality. And I'm glad I got you here, because just this term, I've always wanted to talk to somebody about it. You know, reality isn't virtual, and the virtual world isn't real. And you're the father of a contradiction. Am I right?
The term virtual reality has a history to it, and it goes way back. There was an art theorist named Suzanne Langer who used the term virtual world to describe an idea about art. And then the first headset for virtual reality was created by Ivan Sutherland, the father of computer graphics, in the 60s. And so he used the term to describe what you saw through the headset, the virtual world. And what I wanted to do is make that social, so there would be multiple people and they'd have to have bodies so they could see each other, which was the avatar. And I thought reality was a way to move from virtual world to something that was shared by people. So that's the origin of the term.
Is reality good enough? I mean, what drove you to make this your life's work? What drove you to put bodies in the virtual space?
Well, for me, it started off incredibly personal. What happened was my mom died when I was a kid, and I was a pretty odd kid anyway, I suppose. And I ended up feeling just so isolated and so separated from people. One day I was staring at a Hieronymus Bosch painting, you know, the Garden of Earthly Delights, the really, really strange one. Sure. And I thought, it's amazing that an artist can share something with other people that's not real, but comes from inside themselves, from inside their brain. And I became obsessed with this idea that by doing things, by making things, we could actually connect with people in a way that just seemed elusive otherwise. And I was just obsessed. God, I just longed for some kind of a dream machine where you could be inside a sort of a waking state dream and improvise it. I had this vision of it from that time. And much later, in my 20s, I started the first virtual reality company to try to create that. Now, of course, what we were doing for money was things like surgical simulators and vehicle design simulators and all that kind of stuff. But that was really what was going on for me.
Was this a form of escapism for you? Is that how you envisioned it for others? Or was it more of just an extension of reality that could connect people?
Yeah. Oh, it was completely about connecting with other people. It was the opposite of escapism. I had no need for escapism. I was already escaped. I was like off in my own world. What I really was trying to find was a way back. So for me, it's about trying to find yet new ways to understand what's going on inside other people and to share with them what's going on inside me. It's a quest to make a new thing that's like language, but covers different and maybe deeper territory.
Do you ever worry that maybe they won't connect people in the way that you'd hoped, and that maybe people will use them to isolate themselves?
You know, I think that can happen. But if you want to talk about the dark side of virtual reality, there's one that's darker than that. Let's just go all the way here. And the dark thing is that a virtual reality system can be thought of as the ultimate behavior modification device. It's like putting a rat in some experiment where you measure everything the rat does and immediately change the environment of the rat to create a feedback loop to train it to be different. And we already see something a little like that with today's social media, which is super crude compared to where virtual reality is going. And if we don't get our act together as a society, virtual reality could really be so manipulative and so dark, it could be the end of us. I mean, I just have to be clear about that. So it has an incredible good side and an incredible bad side.
There's a story in your book about technology that you helped invent in the surgical ward, in the surgery room, coming back into your life and into your wife's life as well.
Yeah, that's true. And I wish it weren't true, but what's happened in the last few years, my wife's been battling cancer, and she was saved by a surgical procedure that had been in part prototyped and trained for in virtual reality. And many years ago, I'd co-created the first surgical simulator with a Stanford surgeon named Joe Rosen. And my wife's surgeon was trained by a person that Joe trained. So there was like this direct closing of a circle so many years later. And this is why we can't turn away from technology. We can't say, oh, this is horrible, it's manipulating us, we must just smash all the computers. We really do need them. They're not only lifesavers, they can also create great beauty. And there's just no turning back. We can't undo where we are. We just have to become wiser. We have to become tougher. We can't let them manipulate us.
I've been amazed to read that so much of this for you is about music.
Yeah, see, to me, music is the thing people have done in the past that's the most like what I hope virtual reality will be like. Because with music, people can get together and improvise these structures of enormous sophistication and complexity right in real time, as fast as they can perceive them. And this notion of just creating worlds together is, I think, what virtual reality is going to be all about. And the way we do it in music involves these technologies, these musical instruments that are the most expressive user interfaces ever designed. So to me, music is absolutely the inspiration for virtual reality in every detail. And I'm an instrument obsessive. I have a vast number of instruments that I play, and really too many. It's a sickness. It's nothing to brag about.
And you really do feel like your virtual reality work is an extension of that, right? An extension of that music obsessiveness, that instrument obsessiveness.
Yeah, you know, I do. And in fact, some of the early virtual worlds that I built, just to try to push how far I could go and to figure out how to make things work, involved simulating fantastical musical instruments inside virtual reality. And one of those worlds is even described in the book, and there's a video of it you can watch from a link at the end of the book. To me, it's the best test of really making virtual reality usable and, you know, making sure that people can actually be eloquent with it.
Jaron Lanier is the computer scientist who first coined the term virtual reality, and he's author of the new memoir, Dawn of the New Everything, Encounters with Reality and Virtual Reality. Well, we're going to leave you with this today. On this day in 1877, inventor Thomas Edison announced a new audio invention to the world, the phonograph. Here he is in 1927 talking about his first ever recording.
The first words I spoke in the original phonograph, a little piece of practical poetry. Mary had a little lamb, it squeaked white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Well, where did it go from there? The 78, the 45, 33 and a third, reel-to-reel, the cart, the cassette, the A-track, CD, MP3, the WAV file? Choose your format. Thomas Edison, he made your playlist and our podcast possible. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening over radio. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
PRI, Public Radio International.